for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Belgium's capital, Brussels, remains on high terrorism alert today. Weekend raids failed to turn up a key suspect in the November 13 attacks on Paris. French President Hollande will meet with President Obama tomorrow before heading to Moscow for a meeting at the Kremlin. We talk in this hour about the spread of Islamic extremism and whether a global coalition to fight it could include Russia. Here with me, Robin Wright of the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Wilson Center, Jordi Hamid of the Brookings Institution, and David Gartenstein-Ross of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. From his studio at Stanford University, former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. We do, as always, invite you to be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to join you.
Good morning.
And to you, Ambassador McFaul, President Obama in Malaysia yesterday said that he had some doubts about Russia being part of a coalition to fight ISIS. What do you believe the expectations are that the U.S. has of Russia, and what is in doubt?
Well, I'm told that President Obama had a productive meeting with President Putin when they met in Turkey and had some glimmers of hope that Russia might be rethinking its strategy in Syria. But expectations are low for a number of reasons. First, Russia, as it's gotten more involved militarily in Syria to date, has mostly focused its efforts not against ISIS or ISIL, but against other forces that they call extremists that we call the moderate opposition. There's been some signs that's changing, but just moderate signs. Second, Russia supports Assad. We think Assad must go. That disagreement hasn't changed. And third, the way that Russia conducts its air campaigns and its airstrikes, they have different rules of engagement. By an account that Al Jazeera was reporting on earlier this morning, they've already killed 500 civilians, 130 children. Over time, that if that kind of campaign endures, that's going to help ISIS and not actually help, I think, the overall war campaign. So those are some of the reasons why I think the administration is engaging Russia. They want to be on the same side, but they're also nervous about what it might mean to have Russia more involved.
On the other hand, considering the fact that President Putin himself has said a bomb brought down a Russian plane and acknowledged the deaths of those passengers, do you think that that may affect President Putin's thinking?
It most certainly did. There's no question that it did. There's no question that they have started now, as in the aftermath of that tragedy, to attack some ISIS targets. But in the long run, they think they're better off, in terms of their strategy, to polarize this war between ISIS and Assad. And then when it's a choice between those two evils, they hope that everybody will say, we need to support Assad. And to date, the Obama administration disagrees with that assessment. So do I, by the way. I agree with the administration in that if Assad stays, that will make it unlikely. You can't have peace in Syria with Assad in power. Now, what are the parameters? When he should go? Could he have an honorific role in the transition? All of that is subject to negotiation. It's not a black and white thing. And when I was in the government, I participated in the negotiations with the Russians, so-called Geneva I and Geneva II. We were never militant about that timeline, but strategically in the long run, I don't believe, and I know the administration doesn't believe, that there can be peace and stability under an Assad regime. The Russians, to date, still disagree.
And now President Obama is under increasing pressure to do more in the fight against ISIS. The UK, the British Prime Minister, is now saying he wants Britain to strike ISIS in Syria. Do you believe, Mr. Ambassador, that the U.S. should be doing more?
Yes, I do. I have for a long time. And I think it's a healthy debate that we're having now to think about the ways to do more. But I want to say two things that people need to remember. First of all, under a campaign called Operation Inherent Resolve, the United States and our coalition forces have already attacked ISIS over 8,000 times. I want to repeat that, 8,000 airstrikes. I don't think most Americans know that because of the way it's being portrayed. And the reason the administration doesn't talk much about Operation Inherent Resolve is because it hasn't achieved many results. And I think that's a fundamental dilemma that we need to be honest about, that an air campaign against a terrorist organization in the desert of Syria and Iraq is unlikely to achieve success. Second, having said that, I do think there are more things that should be done, and I welcome the things that the administration has said, and I think we can add to that in terms of increasing the pressure on ISIS and also increasing the pressure to get a political transition underway in Syria.
Michael McFaul, he's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He served as ambassador to Russia. Turning to you, Robin Wright, President Putin is in Tehran today for talks with Iranian leaders. What's at stake for Iran and Russia in reaching a political solution in Syria that includes or does not include President Assad?
Well, both Iran and Russia feel very strongly about having and retaining Syria as an ally. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it includes President Assad. But both countries are deeply worried about what the alternative is. And in 5 years of conflict, there has not been the emergence of a single viable political leader or party that would be able to coalesce the very fractious society, arguably more fractious than at any time since Syria became independent from France after World War II. And so for the time being, they are both willing to challenge ISIS. Iran is very nervous about the rise of Sunni extremists who've come within 25 miles of their border on the Iraqi frontier, and worried about just the rise of Sunni extremism in general because Iran is the world's largest Shiite country. They're worried about the deepening sectarianism spreading across the region. Neither country wants the Middle East to become dozens or even hundreds of little mini-states that are not viable, that create tremendous instability in lots of different ways, not just to the region. And I think both of them are willing to allow Assad and his mafia to eventually exit. The question has always been from both Moscow and Tehran, what do you do? Who's the alternative? And the United States and its 60 partners in the coalition have not yet been able to come up with despite many attempts at anyone who is appealing to the majority of Syrians. And that's left a huge vacuum that's in some ways as dangerous for the future as the chaos of today.
Shadi Hamid, you're skeptical about the idea of a coalition which includes Russia.
Exactly. I mean, over the past 4 years, our Syria policy has been built on the foundation of wishful thinking, this notion that Iran and Russia can be constructive partners, even though they've proved time and time again that they aren't and that they won't be. So we had Geneva 1, Geneva 2. We've had many of these efforts. They've all failed. And I think that it's amazing to me that we've almost forgotten what happened just 6 weeks ago that Russia got involved in Syria with a military intervention and airstrikes that, as Ambassador McFaul was saying, were targeting not ISIS, but ISIS's opponents. That was just in September. So it's almost as if we've forgotten that, and now we have this hope that Russia will change overnight. Now, it's possible that Russia will shift somewhat, but unless they can show good faith and show that they're serious about fighting ISIS instead of just using rhetoric about it, then we should kind of withhold optimism and instead put pressure on the Russians and the Iranians. And I feel like with this Vienna process that is ongoing, we've indulged them instead of putting pressure on them, and we've deferred to their demands and their conditions. And that's why Russia and Iran are happy with the Vienna process. That's why Assad is happy with the Vienna process. Who's not happy? The Syrian opposition.
Shadi Hamid, he is with the Brookings Institution and author of Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Short break. We'll be right back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, Robin Wright is with me. She's at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Shadi Hamid is at the Brookings Institution. David Gartenstein-Ross is at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. He's on the line with us. His former ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. I want to start with you, David, since I did not get to you before the break. I wonder what you see as the risks for the various countries who might come together as part of a coalition.
I think there are tremendous risks in Syria. And I think that both Ambassador McFaul and also Shadi did a very good job of articulating some of the dangers of Russian involvement in particular. I think one other danger we should acknowledge, you know, listening to the first segment, I didn't hear the word Al-Qaeda. I didn't hear mention of the Nusra Front, which is their Syrian affiliate. And one of the other risks, I think, that's worth interjecting is the fact that when we talk about the moderate opposition, it's come out in recent weeks as U.S. officials talked about Russian strikes, where what we regard as the moderate opposition has been located. Officials have talked to the Associated Press, the Wall Street Journal, about how they were able to gain ground in Idlib, in Hama. And when you look at those areas, those are areas where a coalition known as Jaish al-Fatah, the Army of Conquest, of which the Nusra Front, al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate, is a major, major player. I would argue the biggest player. And the policies we've seen in Idlib toward the Druze are softer than ISIS's policies, but also genocidal. The Druze have been made to openly relinquish their faith. They've been put in religious re-education classes. And so that makes this even messier, the fact that the theory behind the moderate opposition is for them to work with al-Qaeda in the short term and then eventually reach a place where they can break with them. But I think that is an extraordinarily dangerous game.
Here's an email from Marcia, who says President Obama needs to go to President Putin of Russia, and together the United States and Russia, along with Iran, form a worldwide coordinated coalition to defeat ISIS. Next, the U.S. must drop its demand that President Assad must go. Who are we to make that demand? Robin, how do you see that?
Well, I think actually we're beginning to see this week in the frenzy of diplomacy with the president of France coming to Washington, meeting with the Germans. He met today with the British. He's going to see Vladimir Putin on Thursday. We're beginning to see an attempt to pull together Russia, Europe, and the United States in greater unity of purpose anyway. Than at any time since the Second World War. Now, will it work? You know, there's a glass half full, glass half empty. We have a common enemy, but we have different goals when it comes to what happens in Syria. And so there is always going to be suspicion and doubt about what Russia ultimately will do when it comes down to post-ISIS or post-Assad Syria. This is, you know, we're in a very precarious place. And I'm not sure we're in a position to ever kind of dictate who will rule next. The whole purpose, and the administration has emphasized this over and over and over, is that it's up to the Syrians to decide who rules them. We learn from our experience in Iraq that it doesn't work to try to impose someone or to try to impose a system. And so I think the lessons of Iraq haunt and shape what's happening now.
Ambassador McFaul, you have acknowledged that there have been 8,000 airstrikes with very low results. Would not a coalition of the Russians, the Iranians, and the Americans produce something more effective against ISIS or ISIL? And isn't Syria the key to it all?
Well, maybe, but I'm not as expert on Syria as the rest of your guests, but, you know, do you know how many times Assad has attacked Raqqa, the so-called capital of ISIS? I looked it up. I think he's attacked zero times. Do you know how many times the Iranians have attacked? In other words, The idea that this grand coalition is going to come together to fight ISIS, I would support that. But the historical experience is that Assad is not fighting ISIS. He's fighting these other groups who are much more of a threat to him immediately. And the theory of their argument, and most certainly this has been the Russian theory in terms of their fight, is to destroy these more local groups first, and then we'll deal with ISIS. And that, you know, I would support it if it were true, but so far the historical experience doesn't suggest that that is their immediate objective right now.
I oppose a coalition. And I oppose a coalition because it comes down to the question of could you work with Iran, could you work with Russia to moderate their behavior? I think that we're better off keeping our hands as clean as we can. You can't keep your hands completely clean in Syria, but we've already outlined the indiscriminate bombing that the Russians have undertaken. That's going to continue. I don't think we will change that behavior. Also, Iran, when it comes to areas that the Iranians have retaken, which are much more in Iraq than in Syria, but obviously ISIS straddles both countries, they've depopulated areas of Sunnis. I mean, we focus on ISIS's atrocities, and rightly so. But Iran, with the militias that it supports, which are known as Popular Mobilization Committees, PMCs, they've gone in and committed massive atrocities as well, which is really setting the groundwork for this to be, even if ISIS is gone from the scene, a very enduring conflict with a lot of revenge killing. And I don't think we're going to change that.
So what do you think may come out of the talks between President Obama and President Hollande tomorrow, Shadi?
Well, you know, I think that, to be honest, not so much. I mean, Obama has been pretty clear that he doesn't want to shift in strategy. And I was somewhat surprised to see just 3 days after the Paris attacks, Obama said this in Turkey. He said, we will double down on what we're already doing, but there will be no shift. And this was surprising to me because, you know, you have to kind of discuss these issues, have an open debate, and consider the various options. But already Obama was preemptively ruling out more aggressive, more involved options.
He said he was doing so with the agreement and consultation with his top military advisors.
I don't doubt that he was talking to his top advisors, but again, I mean, that's a very quick turnaround. I don't know if you can make that determination 3 days after an attack. And this shows that Obama isn't really responsive to changes on the ground. As events rapidly change in the Middle East, Obama has been remarkably rigid. I mean, for someone who kind of claims to be a guy who likes what works, he doesn't seem comfortable reviewing or reassessing his behavior. And especially on Syria. So we're talking about 4 years, and he stay the course. What does ISIS have to do to kind of push us as Americans to fundamentally rethink our strategy?
What kind of strategy do you think might work?
So I think one thing is in Syria to consider no-fly zones, no-drive zones, safe zones that could protect Syrian civilians and also give mainstream Syrian rebel forces a chance to hold and govern territory and provide a governance alternative to ISIS.
And Robin, you have a very different view.
I do. I've been down along that border, and I worry that the no-fly zones are not a viable way to achieve either of our goals. It's terribly appealing because it sounds like we're doing something. But look at Iraq. We had no-fly zones in Iraq for 5 years, and we still had to send in ground troops to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And in Syria, the geography is just very different than it was in Iraq. There aren't a lot of major populated areas along that border that would be viable centers. Most of the areas have been depopulated. People are not going to come back where there's no economy, and many of the refugees don't have homes there. They'd be coming back to what's alien turf anyway. I just don't see that at this stage of the game as an alternative, even though it sounds tremendously appealing. We'd all like to be doing more. It's the same problem in a different way as the question of sending in ground troops. It's not going to be an appealing, the deeper we get into it, whether it's in a no-fly zone or sending troops on the ground, the longer we're likely to be there and be held responsible for creating Syria all over again.
So what is your expectation of the meeting between President Obama and President Hollande?
Well, I'm not sure I'm as pessimistic as Shadi is. I think diplomacy is... There is an incentive now. There is a rallying cry. There is unity of global opinion that ISIS has got to go. And so I think that there will be an increase in intelligence efforts, special forces efforts, a lot of the kind of things that are not necessarily visible.
But still no troops on the ground as the U.S. is concerned.
And I don't think the Europeans are eager to send ground troops either. And that's the great problem. I mean, everyone knows that there's no military solution, that airstrikes alone can't do it. And so the question is, how do you do it? And that's why everybody will hold their nose if they're going into some kind of collaborative strategy with the Russians and the Iranians. I mean, nobody wants to have to deal to trust either country. But if you've got two problems here, one is ISIS and one is Assad, and you can't solve one without the other. And the Russians and the Iranians are unfortunately pivotal to solving the question of Assad and Syria's future.
Ambassador McFaul, as the diplomat on this panel, what do you expect to come out of the meeting between President Obama and President Hollande?
Well, not much. I agree with others on the panel. I think the more interesting meeting will be between Putin and the French president, where he's going to fly 48 hours later. And the question on the table will be, will Russia engage in a more proactive way to think about a settlement?
And what does that mean precisely from your perspective?
Well, I participated in the earlier failed attempts. What it means in reality is, will they be willing to put pressure on Assad and his regime? By the way, we keep talking about Assad. There's a regime there. There's a government there. And our argument when I was in the government is, we don't want regime change. We don't want state collapse. although the Russian position has led to that. I want to be clear that their strategy for the last 4 years has also failed. But instead, can we work with some elements within the regime to sit down with some elements of somebody that would represent the Sunnis? And I fully take the point that that's a very difficult question, especially when al-Nusra is fighting with members of the groups that we call the moderate opposition. But could they sit down to map out a roadmap to the future? And words like democracy and who's going to rule and the Assyrian people are going to rule, in my view, those are all kind of second and third order issues. There has to be a settlement among these groups. And that group, that coalition, would be the coalition that would eventually fight ISIS. If they're fighting against each other, we have no chance against ISIS, even with the Russians and the Iranians involved. I just don't believe there's a long-term future there without that kind of political settlement first.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The question becomes, Ambassador McPhail, how much do you think President Obama is willing or ready to compromise on the absence of Assad in a transition?
I think we were a long time ago when I was still in the government. Very willing to cooperate on that. We looked at other alternative models. I mean, there were other transitions around the world historically where you do deals with dictators, where you do deals with you know, nasty regimes. Now, most of them have not included somebody that's killed a quarter of a million people. And I think it's important to remember that we may think it may be great to have Assad, you know, call him, you know, put him in transition for a while. Maybe he goes into exile. But, you know, a lot of Syrian people and a lot of the Syrian opposition would not accept that. And if we take seriously what Robin said earlier, that we should let the Syrian people decide, you know, a lot of Syrians, maybe millions of Syrians, don't want Assad to be in power. So that's the dilemma. But, you know, I do think at some point it really is that the Russians and the Iranians have to start to put the pressure on Assad. In the last two times that I participated, Geneva 1 and Geneva 2, they were not willing to put that pressure on the president.
Shadi.
So I think that, you know, whenever ISIS strikes, we have a chorus of people in Washington and elsewhere that say, oh, Assad is the lesser evil. We have to work with him against the greater evil. But I think it's really important to emphasize that the Assad regime's policies are one of the root causes of ISIS's rise. And I tend to see, you know, in understanding ISIS, the center of gravity to me is more in Syria than Iraq. That's where ISIS was revived and rejuvenated. And then we see the spillover into Iraq. So this idea that the Assad regime can be a part of the solution if we cooperate with them, it's a very odd way of thinking. And it shows that we like this short term reactionary approach to policymaking, that we say, well, oh, we have to deal with these guys now and we can worry about the other stuff later. We have to have a long term, at least semi coherent vision. And I don't see Assad negotiating in good faith unless there's a credible threat of military force. We have to be negotiating from a position of strength. But really, for the last 4 years, the U.S. has been in a weak position in Syria because we're so uninvolved. We're doing very little to support the mainstream rebel opposition. So there has to be a real kind of recommitment to Syria. And I think that's the key question going forward.
David.
One thing I'd point out is that I think that ISIS's position is a little bit weaker than others on the panel seem to be assessing it. I mean, if you look at ISIS over the course of the past year, they've essentially experienced a year of losses to their territory, with the exception of one very good week in May when they took Ramadi, took Beji, and took Tadmor or Palmyra all in a week. But especially recently, with their losses of Sinjar, Eastern Homs, and Ramadi under pressure, they're in a lot of trouble militarily at the moment.
Debbie Gartenstein Ross, he's with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Short break, and when we come back, your calls, comments. I look forward to speaking with you. welcome back. David, you wanted to finish your thought about ISIS losses. So why don't you do that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the past couple of weeks have been extraordinarily successful for ISIS in terms of their external operations, with the devastating attack in Paris and their attack in Sinai against the Russian plane. And let me say, I agree with Shadi fundamentally that, you know, 3 days after the Paris attack is way too early for Obama to say, I won't reconsider my strategy. I disagree with that approach. And I know that within the military, from my contacts there, there is a lot of disagreement with the current strategy. But I also think it's important that we not just focus on ISIS's strengths, but also their weaknesses. This is fundamentally an organization that has recruited and propagandized around the notion of its own strength. And so the losses they're experiencing in Iraq and Syria, including losing Sinjar, which means that Raqqa and Mosul, their two most important cities, are no longer contiguous. This is significant, and I think that we should pay attention to that. One other thing that's significant as well is the fact that the U.S. is finally bombing their oil tankers, which is an important source of the ISIS economy. So when we're talking about their position, we shouldn't just make it out to be ISIS is winning and nothing is stopping them. Paying attention to the losses as well, I think, will give us some clues as to what may be the most effective shift in our own direction.
All right, let's open the phones first to Stan in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead, sir.
First, just a few comments on the air war. We have the perfect equipment in the A-10, the Warthog, and the C-130. I mean, they're brilliant planes. And finally, after the attack in Paris, we saw some use of them. They're excellent. Secondly, what have we learned from changing leadership or regimes in the Middle East from going back to 1950s and changing with the Shah, and then Egypt, Libya, Iraq, and now we want to change the leadership in Syria? I don't think that Assad is a great person, but he can certainly keep order in a different way than all these different groups can. So that's basically my comments.
All right. And Robin, you'd like to comment?
Well, look, Assad is responsible for the vast majority of deaths in the Syrian conflict. It was his resistance, his use of arms against peaceful dissidents that led to the civil war and at least 250,000 deaths. This is a country that has been so totally devastated. He has no claim to stay in power. And for all the effectiveness of the air war in pushing back ISIS, the core problem gets back to how do you save Syria itself? And we talk so much about ISIL. We're not talking about a lot, as David said, of the other extremist groups, the other militias that are on the ground. There are 1,000 of them if you consider even the small little neighborhood gangs. And we're not talking about the issue of whether we can actually hold Syria together as one state, artificially created a century ago. It went through 7 coups in the first 2 decades of its existence, independence from France. It was the Hassad dynasty, ironically, that emerged and was welcomed initially because it introduced stability. And the problem is it also introduced and used tactics that were bloodthirsty in the name of keeping Syria together. So the bigger question when we talk about whether it's ISIS or Assad is Syria itself. And this is something that really isn't on the table and we don't have a strategy about and concerns me a lot because unless you deal with what you want Syria to be and are you going to invest your muscle, your might, your diplomatic leverage to hold it together, it's quite possible that even if Assad's gone and ISIS is out, that the Syrians themselves can't hold together.
All right, let's go to Levi in Winter Haven, Florida. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. As your guest mentioned, with 8,000 strikes launched against the group ISIS, why has the Pentagon been largely unsuccessful in defeating the group? And the second question is, how would foreign powers distinguish between these separate groups on the ground?
Ambassador McFaul.
Well, with respect to the first question, there's a big history and studies that shows that air power is not in and of itself effective at defeating groups like this. And this is not unique to Syria and Iraq, by the way. There's a big literature that shows that. So to actually defeat them will require ground, somebody to fight them on the ground. Although I do want to underscore what David said, there has been successes. This has not been a good year for ISIS. They've lost 20% of the territory, according to the administration. And over time, the ability to push back on them and contain them is succeeding, despite our latest debate. And the fact that they can pull off a terrorist attack against the Russians in Lebanon or in Paris is not evidence that they're increasing their power inside Syria.
But then we're faced with the question of what the attacks in Paris and the threats to Brussels say about the Islamic group's strength and their desire to move forward. David?
I think they've had a desire for quite some time to attack Western countries. They've flagged that from the very outset. And in January of this year, actually authorities interrupted a plot in Brussels that looked very much like the France plot. You know, one of the plotters, Abdelhamid Abaoud, was also involved in the Brussels plot, which seems like it was also an attempt to undertake urban warfare-style attacks. I think what they've gotten better at is their operations. Like, their external operations are more effective. If you go back 4 years and describe this exact plot, most counterterrorism professionals would tell you that it was basically impossible to do something like this in Europe. I mean, the plot involved 8 attackers, plus there was another interlocking cell. And as more information has come out about Brussels and Germany, there may have been other interlocking cells, which is an enormous amount to get under the radar of authorities. The second thing I'll say in terms of their intentions is I think you could visualize what ISIS is going to do as two different lines, one ascending and one descending. The descending line represents their power declining in Iraq and Syria because it is declining. But they really, as I said, propagandize around the notion of strength. That's why they're okay with being so overtly brutal in a way that no other jihadist group has been. I mean, al-Qaeda is very brutal, but they don't propagandize around brutality the same way that ISIS does. So the ascending line is that even as their power declines, they're going to probably try to make up for that with more terrorist attacks outside of Iraq and Syria. We've already seen them do this in a lot of places, including the awful Tunisian beach attack, attacks in Saudi Arabia's eastern province, an attack on a Shia mosque in Kuwait, attacks in Yemen. But I think that's basically the way they're going to shift, becoming a little bit less of a quasi-state and a little bit more of a terrorist organization. And as their strength as a state declines, their terrorist operations probably will increase.
Shit.
So, you know, as David is saying, I mean, ISIS with the Paris attacks is able to recreate this sense of momentum. But I think I'd go even a little bit further and say, sadly, I hate to say this, but ISIS has been successful this past week. I mean, if you look at the anti-Muslim sentiment, anti-refugee sentiment, the things that our presidential candidates in this country are saying, they are feeding into this narrative of a civilizational war. And that's something that ISIS benefits from. I mean, I can't believe the things that I've been hearing. I've never seen this kind of anti-Muslim sentiment in my own country. And Europe is also very troubling as well, and has been for quite some time, in terms of European Muslims and how they feel in their own countries. So we have to be, it's not just about what ISIS does, it's about what we do in response. And that's where we have the control. And I think that's where we're failing.
All right, to May in New York City. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, good morning. A few things. Number one, let's remember that ISIS was not created by the Syrian regime or in Syria. It was after the invasion of the Iraq by U.S. that this vacuum was created. Number two, as we continue to support countries like Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia who fund and arm those terrorist groups, the problem is getting bigger. Number three, there's no civil war in Syria. I think it's a Syrian crisis. All these are imported Islamic jihadis coming to fight on Syrian soil. And any armed opposition is not a legitimate one. We would not approve an armed opposition in the U.S., so why should we approve it on foreign soil?
What do you think, Robin?
Well, look, I think history will probably look back and say the United States bears culpability for the chaos that has come out of Iraq. Intervention in 2003, when there wasn't an al-Qaeda cell there, did lead to the mobilization of discontent and Sunni extremists. And that, of course, led to the creation of al-Qaeda of Iraq that then eventually morphed into what is today ISIS. So she's right on that point. You know, there are some questions about, are we supporting some of the regimes, notably in Saudi Arabia, that whose ideas and resources have fueled some of the extremist groups across the region, whether it's al-Qaeda or ISIS. Again, it'll be very interesting to see how history judges the nature of those kinds of alliances.
All right. To Dr. Abraham in Eaton, Ohio, you're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I look at the, you know, kind of the bigger picture, rather than talking just on, you know, the unfortunately coward attacks in Paris, Beirut, Nigeria by Boko Haram, and on Philippines by Abu Sayyaf or al-Qaeda. I see, like, if you collect all these pieces together, we find that more than 95% of the terrorism in the world is actually caused by the Wahhabi Saudi ideology. And for a better future, you know, future for our children, we owe it to them that we should hit the cancer at the center and educate and save those, you know, terrorist suicide people and their victims by really stop calling them our allies. And we need, as I said, owe it to the future to really fight that ideology and educate people.
All right. Thanks for your call, Ambassador McFaul.
Well, generally, I agree. I mean, as the previous caller, May, I believe was her name, said as well, we need to take a closer look at how these groups are being supported, how the flow of jihadis into Syria is happening. It's a complicated issue, and to say it's the regimes, it's the regimes, maybe it's individual organizations, but to have a much closer scrutiny of these relationships and then to disrupt them, I think is something that there on that front, by the way, that is a front in which you could build an international coalition and make that a focus, even if we can't agree on these other things. And in our country itself, we need to have a debate about our bilateral relationships with some of these regimes and their allies within their countries. Make them take responsibility.
You agree, Debbie?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think that you know, groups like this don't just spring up in a vacuum. There are many things that contribute to the growth of these organizations, but understanding the ideological underpinnings and, you know, the fact that they're still getting support, and I think probably more so at a regime level than previously, is just a fundamentally important part of where we are in 2015.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The question becomes, what should the U.S. and its European allies be doing now with or without the aid of Russia? Robin.
Well, there are no appealing choices, none. And we face one of the toughest, messiest conflicts ever in the Middle East with lots of different layers. It's a civil war. It has proxy wars. It has sectarian dimensions. It plays out on so many levels. And the danger is that the Iraq model of going in and flooding the place with American troops, occupying, trying to rid the bad guys, whether they're extremists or a bad regime, and then trying to create an alternative, isn't appealing to Americans right now. I don't think, in terms of whether it's the human capital or the national treasury, that it's just beyond what we want to do. And so that limits our alternatives when we know that military airstrikes are not going to do it.
Shady.
So the Iraq War was a formative moment in my political education, and I think it'll stand as one of the great strategic blunders. However, we have to be careful about overlearning the lessons of the last war. We can't see everything through the prism of our past mistakes. The situation in Syria is not comparable to Iraq. It's a very different context. So I think that, as uncomfortable as I am, and I even hesitate to say this, first of all, I mean, no one's talking about a full-scale invasion of Iraq, but at least let's have a conversation.
You don't mean Iraq.
Sorry?
Do you mean?
Yeah, yeah, an Iraq-style invasion like we had in 2003. Okay. I mean, no one's talking about that, but I do think that we have to have a conversation about at least a small contingent of ground troops. Let's at least talk about it as a nation and weigh the options. Instead of, from the get-go, preemptively precluding these options, that's not the way you defeat an enemy when you have certain options that you will never consider no matter what changes on the ground.
So you would put troops on the ground?
No. I didn't quite say that. I think we have to talk about it. I don't think it should be ruled out prematurely.
All right. Yeah. And David?
I think we need to understand that we have an enormous national interest in there being less war in Syria. I fully agree with what the other guests have said about how Assad bears his enormous share of the culpability for what has happened. My big concern is, let's say Assad were to topple tomorrow. You know, another leader who did not deserve to lead his country is Najibullah in Afghanistan. You know, the communist regime, backed by the Russians, did enormous damage to the Afghan people, but when he fell, it left the country in civil war that has never ended since.
So what would you do right now?
I think that, number one, the policy proposals for creating more ceasefires on the ground is something I would take very seriously. I think we need to look for a way to usher Assad out, but I would issue a concern that if he were simply to fall, then things could actually get worse as the country falls into anarchy.
And finally, to you, Ambassador McFaul, we have only a few seconds.
I would like to be on your next hour and talk about Frank Sinatra, because that's a much easier task. I just share Robin's view. This is really hard. And the two things that need to be done, more pressure on ISIS through supports of special forces, through the Kurds, and also reengaging in a real political solution, a settlement, because if you don't do that, you'll never solve the problem of ISIS
right.
in the long term.
We'll have to leave it at that. Michael McFaul, David Gartenstein-Ross, Shadi Hamid, and Robin Wright. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.